It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job today?
No job today. He's out and about having a vacation.
Huh.
A lucky guy.
Yeah, well, I mean, you just had a vacation there for a couple of weeks.
I did. So it's very important.
He didn't really cover for you because he went somewhere else. He landed in the hospital. So,
mm-hmm.
But again, intended to cover for you. So
yeah.
That's almost the same thing. All right, well, plenty to cover here. And we'll start out with some local stuff.
Some good news this week.
Some good news. Oh, okay, we'll start with that. The University of Washington's Biodefense Lab proposal.
Yes, the proposal to site UW's new biodefense lab has been, actually, the UW says that they will not do it now. They could not get together the $35 million that they needed in, was it private funding they said they were going to need in order to help build a lab? They were hoping to get a $25 million grant from the NIH, right, to begin the construction, and then they thought that bringing in private partners with another $35 billion, they'd be able to build the thing.
Million.
$35 million, yes, sorry. I'm talking in billions because I'm so used to covering the war in Iraq that... It makes anything in the millions look a little bit small. But, and so they could not get any private donors to come forward. And that's not a surprise, really, when you think about the number of biotech companies in the region who already have their own labs. It seemed like a stupid idea in the first place to think that the UW could build a building that they would then share with private companies. That there would be private companies who would just, particularly in this kind of economic climate, just want to jump in there and throw money into something that folks in the neighborhood did not want.
Well, see, I kind of take the opposite on that. I found that actually really surprising that they couldn't pull together $35 million when you consider that just in that one neighborhood over in South Lake Union, they managed to cobble together $25 million for a trolley that's, you know, basically not going to serve anybody. I mean, $35 million in the big picture isn't really that much money in terms of, like, City of Seattle on a lot of things. I mean, it is to you and I, but...
Yeah, but when you're talking about companies having to, like, relocate to a new building, you know, if they throw money into the building, obviously they're going to want to have space in the building, right? They're going to want to rent space from the UW, or they're going to want to be able to have it rent-free. And when you look at the parking and the traffic situation there, particularly with the Montlake Bridge, it just doesn't make sense for any company that's based on the east side or based already closer to downtown to want to go out to the university district and deal with that. It just doesn't make sense to me anyway.
Yeah, well,
but
again,
it's good news.
And I actually think the whole money thing is just... is misleading in that, I mean, the money itself is really an indicator of something about this project scared people off not to invest in it.
And I think the biggest aspect of that was that folks living in the neighborhood put up a stink about it. And so congratulations to those groups who were trying to defeat the biolab.
Well, and it also should be noted that at the Board of Regents meeting that President Mark Emmert stated that, you know, he was disappointed in this one not moving forward, but that they would have to work all the harder for the other projects if this ever came along again. So there's every indication that the University of Washington will be pursuing things like this in the future.
They're learning from this. And, so we need to keep an eye on them.
And as they have spun in their literature and such, they have stated that losing this lab could be a threat to their continuing getting grants for the RCE, the Regional Center of Excellence, which in 2003-2004 was awarded $50 million, which I have seen no proof of yet that, you know, if they don't get these labs, you know, lab space, that won't get the funding.
They have like 30 different labs on campus already, right, working on these
kinds
of projects.
They have 30 BL3s, but what they also fail to note when they're saying that if we don't get more lab space is the fact they already actually are slated $170 million for office and lab space down on Mercer that actually in terms of square footage will have like 6-7 times the square footage that this lab would have had. So it's interesting that they're saying, gosh, you know, we're going to be put out if we don't get more lab space. It's like, well, I don't know if you check your own PR releases, but you guys already have some on the books. So moving along, Southwest Airlines is talking about pulling out of SeaTac. Is that really anything people should be concerned about?
Yeah, they should be. Southwest wants to get together with King County and build a $130 million complex at Boeing Field in order to, as Southwest put it, in order to fly out a lot more budget flights for to serve Seattle residents. Well, there's a problem here, is that if you save a few bucks on your airline ticket by taking Southwest Airlines out of Boeing Field, you're going to pay down the line in tax money to fund improvements for Boeing Field. Now, I don't know if anybody's ever tried to drive to Boeing Field. If you try to drive to Boeing Field, you'll see immediately that it does not have the street capacity to handle an airline flying 30 to 60 flights out of there every day. So what it would require is, and we're already hearing this from King County officials, talk about eventually needing to, if they accept this plan, eventually needing to build a freeway spur to Boeing Field and to make all kinds of road improvements so that it can handle the car traffic. You know, that's got to come, the money for that's got to come from somewhere. We already have a backup of transportation projects that need funding. Just looking at this plan, it's the worst deal I think I've looked at in a long time. Southwest Airlines.
That's saying a lot.
Yeah, really. Southwest Airlines wants to do it because they figure if they can build their own little terminal at Boeing Field, it'll get them out of having to pay for the improvements that are being made at SeaTac Airport. Well, I think King County needs to say, no, look, you can't do that.
All righty. Well, moving along to national things. There seems to be a lot of, security
related issues
this week. One of them was the Patriot Act got renewed.
Yeah, the House voted to pass the USA Patriot Act. The vote was 257 to 171, so it was not even very close. 43 Democrats deserted their party and joined the Republicans in order to vote to pass the USA Patriot Act. And what this was it was a renewal of the Patriot Act. It was supposed to expire this year, so it had like a four-year sunset on the provisions in the Patriot Act. Congress would have to act sometime this year to renew it. Instead of renewing it with another deadline in the Act, what they did is they voted to extend it in perpetuity. So it's going to run forever unless Congress repeals the provisions of the Act. Now, there are two provisions that do have expiration dates. That's the roving wiretaps and searching library and medical records. Congress will come back and revisit those in 10 years. So instead of putting like a two-year deadline on them or a four-year deadline, the deadline's set out there for a decade. So these provisions that we were talking about a month or 2 months ago, saying they should expire, and it was looking like it was possible that large portions of the Patriot Act would expire now with the bombings in London, and in fact a lot of the legislators who voted on it on Thursday came directly from having watched newscasts of the current bombings in London and sat down and said, well, we got to pass this thing, and that's what they did.
But I'm sure those incidents are just coincidence. The London bombings happening right when this was going through.
Now, the Senate Judiciary Committee has passed a very similar bill, and the only difference in there is that there's a four-year expiration date on the two provisions, the roving wiretaps and searching library and medical records. But it looks like the Senate will probably pass this thing in the fall when they reconvene, and then they'll have to reconcile it and send it to George Bush, and certainly he'll sign it.
Any evidence that our lawmakers had actually read the Patriot Act compared to the first time when actually none of them, I think one person had read the Patriot Act?
There actually was some pretty hot debate leading up to it, something like 12 hours of debate before they sat down on Thursday and passed it. But it really was, the kicker really was when these train bombings happened again in London. These Democrats kind of went over to the other side and said, okay, we'll vote for this thing. But it's a sign of how much our congressmen really are sensitive to, not particularly the Democrats, sensitive to the charges that you're soft on crime or you're not tough enough, you're not tough like the Republicans, and you're not security-minded, et cetera, et cetera, that just watching a newscast can change their minds like this. It's amazing.
All right. Well, there were other things that related things that happened this week. One, there were doing searches on the New York subways.
Yeah, and in a related topic, the New York police began on Friday searches on the subway. They were searching about 1 in 5 people with a bag or a backpack who wanted to get on the New York subway, making these searches random. Now, there's a problem with that. Random searches are usually considered unconstitutional. In addition, it makes the searching itself completely ineffective. I mean, terrorists can sit down and they can do the numbers as well as anybody else. A 1 in 5 chance of getting searched means you've got an 80% chance of getting through, of your bag getting through. In addition, what's to stop an attacker from simply strapping explosives to his or her body or, you know, putting them in their shoe like Richard Reed did? And it's not like I'm arguing for pat-downs or strip searches before people get on the bus or something. In fact, I really see this as a huge overreaction, just like the passing of the Patriot Act was this week, a huge overreaction to these bombings in London. And what I want to know is how come we haven't had this kind of reaction? In fact, it seems to be somewhat racist because we haven't had this reaction when, for example, there were bombings of tourist facilities in Turkey last month. We didn't have the same reaction, even though there were Westerners killed in those attacks, as well as Turkish citizens. We didn't have that same reaction any time there were bus bombings in Israel, when in fact there is probably the largest Jewish population in the world outside of Israel in New York. It really ranks, I think, probably the largest Jewish population in the world. We didn't have pat-downs of... We didn't have, you know, searches of people getting on buses and subways in New York after those kinds of incidences. So it's really obviously a major overreaction. And the interesting thing is New York City is lagging on some very, very important security things that they could do that are very practical. And one of those things is that the Metropolitan Transit Authority has budgeted $600 million for security. And they did this 2 years ago, but they've only spent about $30 million of that. That's less than 5%. Of that budget that they set aside for security. They've only spent that much in 2 years. In addition, subway workers, as soon as the searches were instituted, subway workers called together a press conference, and they said, look, you know, we've been given almost no training for emergencies, so we have no clue what to do when one of these things happen. Don't you think it would be important for the city of New York, instead of spending $2 million in police overtime per day searching the subways now, to spend a little bit of money to train us in what to do in case of an emergency like this? So it's pretty clear what's going on here with the security stuff. It's becoming something like a police state now, you know, without anything really practical, without anybody sitting down and saying what are the practical things we can do to protect people.
Well, and it looks like another area where those that are supposedly out there to protect us are spending their time. The FBI is looking into those questionable terrorist groups like Greenpeace and the ACLU.
Yeah, you would think that post 9/11, the FBI would have something better to do, but no. This week in federal court, the FBI disclosed that it's been keeping files on the ACLU and Greenpeace. It's collected something like 1,173 pages of information on the ACLU and something like 2,383 pages on Greenpeace. And also has been spying on United for Peace and Justice, which is a coalition of more than 1,000 different peace groups all over the country. So, I mean, it's one thing to go to a Michael Moore film and have him say, look, you know, the FBI is spying, and local police departments are spying on these peace groups, you know, little old ladies and church people sitting together sharing cookies. It's another thing to have the FBI admitted in court, and that's what happened this last week. So it's another example of where the government, as with the passage of the USA Patriot Act, the government is extending its own rights at the expense of our privacy rights.
Well, and it actually shouldn't be surprising based on
our civil rights.
Just a little ways back when they had announced that groups, the environmental groups that they have labeled as terrorists, ALF, ELF, that they would be, you know, looking into the financial ties to the larger groups, the Sierra Club.
Which is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, but that they would be pursuing that and pursuing. If you gave money to the Sierra Club, they would consider you as someone who is suspect because somehow the money from the Sierra Club might get to these other groups.
Might trickle down or somehow get to these other groups, which is very bizarre as anyone who has ever actually had any experience on environmental issues.
All right. Well, let's jump over to international then, and This Week in Iraq.
The big news on Iraq this week is the brouhaha over Seymour Hersh's article in The New Yorker. He reported that $40 million in U.S. government money has been spent to covertly influence Iraqi elections, the elections that were held in January. Now, there were immediate denials from the Bush administration, who came out and said, various spokesmen came out and said, well, we had discussed it but not approved it. We had not decided to do it. It was a plan that got shelved. But, in fact, if you read Seymour Hersh's article, what he says, he quotes several anonymous sources, but he says that they are people who actually worked on the plan, and he does name one or two of them. He says that the money was approved, was spent, was used to finance Ayed Alawi's campaign, and it definitely skewed the elections in January, which makes an absolute mockery of the notion that we have brought democracy to Iraq, although we could say that we bought our version of democracy in Iraq. The name of the column is, quote, Get Out the Vote, and it ran in The New Yorker, the issue dated July 25th. So as folks who are familiar with magazines know, that magazines often have a date in the future when they're the current issue on the newsstand. So it's going to be out there until late July. I suggest people go pick up a copy and read that article. It's a very good article. And you can use it when you argue with your right-wing friends about why we went into Iraq in the first place. Now, in spite of spending $40 million to try to get Ayed Alawi elected, the other guys actually won. Now, who are the other guys, according to the U.S. government? They were most concerned about the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Folks will remember, too, that Skiri, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, was one of the exile groups that came into the country right after the U.S. invasion, and that they have received assistance from us in the past. We now consider them the bad guys and are concerned about their ties to Iran. Now that there were supposed to be free elections in Iraq. Well, the Supreme Council did actually end up being on top in the elections, even though they didn't win with the majority that they thought they would. They do dominate the coalition of Shiite groups that have the majority in the new government. They've been very active since coming to power in January. In this week alone, they signed a deal with the government of the neighboring country of Iran to build three pipelines connecting the two countries. Those pipelines will be financed by Iran, and they will be used for Iraq to ship about 150,000 barrels per day of crude oil to Iran. And in return, they'll receive refined products, refined petroleum products like gasoline, kerosene, and heating oil, the kind of things that the U.S. government and the U.S. Coalition Provisional Authority have not been able to provide to Iraqis in any meaningful amount. The new pipelines are supposed to be up and running in about 10 months, and that's provided that they can keep them secure with the insurgency going on. Also, you'll remember a couple of weeks ago, Iran promised to extend a $1 billion loan to the Iraqi government and to help train Iraqi troops. Although immediately after that deal was put together, the U.S. ambassador, then Condoleezza Rice, and then finally George Bush squawked about the government of Iran providing training assistance to Iraqi troops, and the Iraqi government then backed off the training portion of that deal, but they are still going to accept the $1 billion loan. Another area where the Supreme Council is making inroads is on the 71-member committee that's drafting a new constitution. The Shiites are in a majority on that committee, and the fundamentalist group that's mostly Skiri representatives, the Supreme Council representatives, they are pushing very hard for Sharia law and for Islam to take a greater role in the government. In particular, there's been a lot of protests in Iraq over Article 14. Article 14 of the draft constitution as it stands so far, as there's a draft being passed around right now, would repeal women's current legal rights in Iraq and replace them with religious law based upon whatever religion the woman has herself, or whatever religion her husband has, or her parents have, or whatever. It doesn't specify what would happen if a woman is from one sect and her husband from another, and women who are familiar with legal courts around the world can guess what would happen in that case. They would probably favor the husband's religion. In the meantime, two Sunni members of the Constitutional Drafting Committee were assassinated this week, and by Friday, all of the Sunni members on the committee had walked out in protest because of the lack of security for the folks working on the committee. Also, I think probably too because of the push by the fundamentalist Shiites on the council to institute Sharia law. So that wraps up this week in Iraq.
Can we bounce back to the pipelines? Seems like a 10-month window for three pipelines being functional seems pretty aggressive.
It does, but I don't think it's impossible. We'll see. Yeah. It might be impossible given the security climate, but you don't know. The pipelines are supposed to be built between Iran and the southern city of Basra, and if you look on a map, that's not very much distance to build a pipeline. So they're not long pipelines. They're short ones.
All right. Well, jumping back to something that we're regularly hearing about, although it's tough to find accurate information, the economy. Is it doing good or bad or what?
Well, we keep hearing from economic analysts now that, the economy is really starting to boom. It's very strong. You know, we've gained 2 million jobs, et cetera, et cetera. And then if you really look hard like I do and you read a lot of the business press like I do, you eventually come across these articles that are much more troubling. Like this week, for example, there were major layoffs announced by Kodak, Hewlett-Packard, and Kimberly-Clark. And they're not laying off a couple thousand people or a couple hundred people. Hewlett-Packard's laying off 14,500 people. Kodak upped the number that they said they were going to lay off. They said initially they were going to lay off about 10,000 to 12,000 people. They approximately doubled that figure to 22 to 25,000 people that they're going to lay off now. And Kimberly-Clark's going to let about 6,000 people go, and they may up the number too. There are other companies out there announcing layoffs as well. In June, in fact, the economy lost 110,996 jobs. Job cuts were announced. That's the highest monthly total in about the last year and a half. That's pretty high. And since the beginning of the year, just in the first 6 months of the year, there have been about 500,000 layoffs around the country. That's not something that we're hearing from these economic analysts. Nobody is really talking about that. At the same time, there are problems with the high levels of debt that Americans have right now. You can look and look and look, and occasionally you see an article or you see a news bit about the high percentages of debt and the very low saving levels that Americans have. One of the big problems right now is that in the 1990s, there was this push for home equity loans, for people to take out home equity loans and to use that money not to, you know, make changes in their house or to do renovations or anything, but to use that money to pay off their credit cards. What's happening now is that a lot of people who went for that scheme, taking out a loan on their house to pay off their credit cards, are now running up huge amounts of credit card debt, which is putting them even deeper into debt than they were before if they had just, you know, worked out a payment plan with their credit card companies. Those folks may be part of those 500,000 people who are losing their jobs. Now, in addition, the latest scheme is the no-interest mortgage. The interest-only mortgage, where you take out a mortgage on a house and your payments are, when you make payments on it, you're paying off the interest only. You're not making any payments on principal. So as you make payments on this mortgage, you are not gaining any equity in your home. The problem with this is that these mortgages allow people who are on the margin, who can't afford to buy a house because they don't make quite enough money, it allows them to buy a house in essence, to spend more than they should be able to spend by running up this huge debt. Now, sometimes, and actually quite more often than it should be, these interest-only mortgages, when you make payments of interest, you're not even making the full interest payment with your payment. So, say, for example, you buy a $250,000 house, and you're making payments of, like, $1,000 a month, your interest may not even cover that, or you're making payments of, say, $500 a month, your payment may not even cover the whole interest being charged for that month. The extra interest gets tacked on to the loan as principal, so your loan balance grows. It does not decrease the way it should in an ordinary mortgage. So instead of $250,000 in principal after your first payment, you may then owe $250,000 in principal plus another, you know, $400 gets tacked on there as interest that you didn't pay that month with that $500 payment. You paid only $500 of $900 that you owed in interest for that month. And so the balance grows and grows and grows and grows and grows. Now, that's, in my book, predatory lending. Now, a lot of times people just pay the full sum of the interest that's due that month, and so they never end up touching the principal until way, way out in the future. And what happens then is it's like the monorail financing that we talked about last month. Instead of paying, you know, around $500,000 for your $250,000 house, which is what's normal in a 30-year mortgage, you may end up paying, you know, four or five times the original $250,000 price tag for that house. Now, what's more likely to happen is that folks never, ever pay off the balance and they die owing money in a situation like that. Now, another thing about these no-interest mortgage loans that are really bad is that they encourage speculation. And by that, I mean a large number of people who take out these mortgages are folks who already own a house, but they want a place to invest their money that will have a higher return than the stock market. So they look at investing in real estate. So they buy a house in a neighborhood where the prices are going up and up and up, and they use an interest only mortgage because they know they're going to make a few cosmetic improvements and then flip that house. In other words, they're going to sell it within months of having bought it. What that does is it encourages people to jump into the real estate market. The more people in the real estate market, the higher the prices go. The higher the prices go, the more people jump in. So this encourages this speculation, and it drives housing costs so high that a lot of people can't afford them. So it really is, I think, a predatory lending practice in that respect as well. And of course, there's no regulation that prevents banks and mortgage brokers from offering these loans, and there should be. So that's just one scheme, one way that the economy has hooked people into huge amounts of debt. And at the same time, people are beginning to really lose their jobs in large numbers. While these corporations cut jobs to improve their balance sheets, the economy from their view looks good, but the economy from our view looks really bad and could get even worse in the next 6 months.
I think we need to get some restraining orders against these predatory lenders.
Yeah, and often predatory lending just refers to, you know, payday loans and stuff, but it should also refer to these kinds of schemes too.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time, but a couple events that are happening today I wanted to let people know about. One of them, happening at the Labor Temple today from 1 to 3 is a Downing Street memo related event with Jim McDermott and Paul Loeb will both be speaking. People getting together, they're going to do
now
a reading.
That's the folks who are asking for the impeachment of Bush over the Downing Street memo stuff, right?
I'm not sure exactly what they're asking for, but they're going to be talking about, you know, what came out of the Downing Street memo and what needs to be done. So
yeah, we do need to educate a lot more about that. It's true.
And in addition, John Ross, who was on the show earlier this morning from 7:30 to 8, will be speaking at Elliott Bay Books today at 4 o'clock. So you can kind of go from one to the other. First one, 1 to 3 at Labor Temple.
And John Ross is a great speaker. So I highly recommend it.
All right. So talking once again with Maria Tomchick, co-editor at Eat the State. Maria, where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes around town. It can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org.